Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. In case you've not been following, but you've been following the show before, you probably noticed there's been a change in the way I've been publishing, the rhythm in particular. So I used to publish weekly, and honestly, I've been pretty slammed at work, so I have reduced the amount of episodes since I've taken over and started in the second season from after my way longer than planned summer break, which you may have followed or you might not have followed, but in case you're a newcomer. So I'm now publishing twice a month, every 2 weeks. So the last episode was 2 weeks ago with strategist Kim McKenzie, a very exciting episode, brand strategist in New York and founder of the Ladies Who Strategize Slack group. If you wanted to go check that out, we talked about a bunch of different stuff, including her studies around cinema and media and TV series, which was great. Just backtracking slightly, if you're brand new to this, and this may well be the case because we have an exciting guest, and I think it's going to attract a few different kinds of people who might not know about the show so far. So if this is your first time listening, welcome. And if it's not your first time listening, well, welcome back. And I really appreciate you listening to another episode. But this is what goes on in the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. We don't specifically talk about ice cream, but I really like ice cream. And let's be honest, who doesn't? Or at least I like to believe that it makes people smile in the first place. And so I'm a brand and marketing strategist, particularly specialized in everything to do with digital, but not only. So I talk to a variety of different clients about their brands, currently heading the strategy team at a creative technology company called Rehab Studio in London. And I also have a personal passion for gaming, in particular tabletop gaming, but not only. And I'm really fascinated by all aspects of play and game. So I've kind of like mashed up the two of those things, or at least brought those two personal and professional passions together in my podcast. And so what I do is I go and find out and have interviews with people whom I find interesting that are related to the areas of brand and marketing strategy and design, or around gaming and game designers and people, and really just have conversations, quite honest and candid conversations about where they're from, where they come from, what their stories are, what inspires them, what's their creative process, and how do they get to be where they are today, essentially, right? And there are a few questions about ice cream towards the end of the show, or each episode, rather. And this is what we've got going on. We have an exciting guest today. We had a fantastic conversation with Maurice Cherry. Maurice is the host of the Revision Path podcast. And Revision Path is a really good design podcast. I had the chance of meeting Maurice when I was at the Podcast Movement Conference in Chicago back in July already. Time flies. I mean, this is just like almost 6 months ago. It's crazy. And I listened to a few of his episodes, and it's really great. So he talks to a wide variety of designers and about themselves, and a very similar format to my podcast, essentially. They're like quite candid interview style conversations, quite open about everything that's going on in the designer's life. So they might be like strategists or web developers, designers. So like the wider area of design. And so I thought there was a lot of cross interest in that. And I really thought it would be great to have a conversation because Revision Path has been running for, I'm going to say a mistake because I haven't checked it again, but I believe it's since 2014. And it's been running for quite a few more episodes than I have, on a regular basis and quite consistent, and some really great guests. And I'd like to shout out that if you go check it out on the revisionpath.com website, or you just look for Revision Path on your favorite podcasting app, we talk about this in the episode. I was supposed to publish it a couple of weeks ago, but I mean, work got in the way, so I was just publishing now. But the advantage is I have the chance of promoting and talking about the fact that Maurice had been invited by Facebook to come and talk at Facebook headquarters in California about what he's been doing with Revision Path and what he's been doing as a web developer and designer consultant with his consultancy called Lunch. And he does a variety of different bits and pieces and side projects that he's going to talk about in the episode. And he also got to interview several designers at Facebook. So from the beginning of November is a bit of love. He's got a couple of exciting people. Number one is Reggie Murphy. Reggie Murphy is a UX research manager at Facebook. And then the following episode, he talked with Carla Cole, and Carla Cole is a product designer at Facebook. So that's definitely worth checking out amongst the latest episodes. And actually, while I was browsing, just because I was looking at the latest episodes I have not had time to listen to yet, Maya Patterson is like the latest bonus episode that Maurice published on the Revision Path podcast. And I mentioned this because she's the product designer at Trunk Club. And Trunk Club are based in Chicago. If you've not heard of them, well, they've been advertising on a bunch of different podcasts, including the Tim Ferriss one, which is how I found out about them. But I've heard from several friends that it's a really amazing closed service where you just kind of basically give you them a little bit of criteria. And I mean, I'm not paid for this. I've just heard that they were really amazing. And I've been looking forward to trying them, but they're not around in Europe as far as I know yet. So I've not been able to do that. Anyway, that's completely by the by on a very different topic. Now, what else can I say about the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast? Don't forget, I've not had any new reviews to talk about, but I usually read reviews, which is an idea I got from Maurice, by the way. So we had a fantastic conversation. We talk about where he came from and where he's from in Alabama, where he lives in Atlanta now, the kind of stories. We talk about music. We talk about a bunch of really fun and interesting and engaging conversations to just get to know him and get to know the host of the Revision Path show, essentially. What else? You can find more episodes on either, obviously, your favorite podcasting app or on my website and find out more about me and what I do as well. So that's on the main Ice Cream for Everyone website. That's www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Icecreamforeveryone.net. You can also find links to register to my weekly newsletter. It's called Ice Cream Sunday. Guess when it's delivered? Every Sunday in your email. It has a bunch of different kind of personal stories, what's been going on with me, some interesting links about what's going on in the world of communications, creative communications, design, branding and marketing, gaming, a bit of what's going on in the news, a funny GIF usually, or at least the news that I've been reading in that current week, and just try to keep it fresh with a few different interesting links and a few stories from you. And we're kind of like, I've recently changed the format, so I'm still figuring out exactly what I'm doing with this new format. So yeah, if you check it out, I'd love to hear like what you think of it. Similarly, if you listen to this podcast, I'm sure you've heard it from loads of other podcasters, and there was one reason why, because it's true and it makes a hell of a difference. I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is at HippoWill. That's HIPPOWILL. Or you can contact me on Facebook. You can look up the Ice Cream for Everyone page on Facebook. There's going to be links at the bottom of this page. And that's one thing. You can email me at Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. And the thing that I would ask that makes a hell of a difference for you is, one, share the episode with a friend. If you enjoyed it, just tell another friend about it. And two, please write a review. Open your podcasting app. If you have an iPhone, that's linked into iTunes. So you can either open iTunes on your computer or open the podcasting app and like leave a review there for the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. It makes a hell of a difference. It helps other people find the show if you like it. And or whatever podcasting app you're using, if there's a review system or a thumbs up system like on Stitcher, which I use, then yeah, by all means, give me that. Now, I've probably been rambling for a little bit too long. So without further ado, here is Maurice. Oh, and one more thing I forgot. It's Thanksgiving. Of course it is. I'm a bad American. I forgot Thanksgiving. I was raised in Europe. What can I say? I apologize. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone. I hope you're having a fantastic day wherever you are. If it's past, good luck on Black Friday or Cyber Monday, whichever, wherever you like shop your food stuff. And here's Maurice again. Hey, Maurice, welcome to the show.
Hi, Willem. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for making time. I'm excited.
Yeah, me too.
I was just running around like kind of Looney Tunes character style, getting everything ready and thinking I don't have, you know, enough time to get myself ready for the questions. So I don't know. Like, does it get easier with time when I'm as experienced as you as a podcaster? Does it get easier?
I would like to say it gets easier. I mean, I don't know what the best way is to put this, but I'm really strict with my own time.
Yeah.
So usually if I know that I've got an interview coming up, I try to block out at least maybe 30 minutes before, just so I'm like in the right mind space. I want to make sure my environment and stuff is together. Mm. And I'm sort of ready to go, but it depends. It depends. I mean, it does get easier. No, I would say with anything, I think it just gets easier with practice.
Yeah. Of course. I picked up which is like, it's good you reminded me because I didn't do this today, but a tip from somebody else that was like, and before preparing for meetings and talks when they were like public speaking, to just watch some comedy beforehand. And that was something that I started doing a few times with interviews that I should start doing again.
Oh, what's the rationale behind that? It just kind of put you in a good mood?
Just put you in a good mood and put you like just loosen up a little bit and put you in the mood for, you know, having some lighter conversation, particularly if you're going to have something heavy or a little bit scary or a little bit intimidating. And I think that was the idea behind it, if I remember correctly. But okay. I thought it worked quite well for me.
No, that sounds like a good idea. I should try that.
Yeah. Do you know who you'd watch? Do you have a go-to comedian?
Oh, God, a go-to comedian. That's a really good question. Maybe Louis C.K. probably is who I would go to. I'm trying to think of someone who has pretty, short clips, because I know that Louis can sometimes kind of go on with anecdotes. That's what I'm thinking of off the top of my head. Him.
It's a great choice. Fantastic choice. So definitely current. Absolutely current. Cool. We met briefly a couple of times at the podcasting conference, the podcast movement in Chicago, which is great to meet you. And I was really happy to meet a few different podcasters. And your show is Revision Path is about design. And, you know, it matches with some of my interests in terms of marketing and strategy and design as well. And so that's the reason why I invited you to come and join the show today, and wanted to find out more about you and, you know, where you're from, what you're up to, and the general kind of random conversations I have with people. They're not completely random, but
okay.
Sure. So let's start with finding out about Revision Path. And one of the things this is an observation I had about the podcast movement. I was wondering if you had the same, and if, because you might have more experience from podcasting conferences, and this was my first. I was glad to come across you because it was a bit random as I was networking and, you know, introducing myself to people, whether the people I would be talking to, whether their podcast would have any kind of synergy with mine. And I was wondering if you found a better way to try to meet people that were, you know, more interested in your space in design in particular, or whatever other fashion that you might have found for trying to meet the right kind of people, quote. I mean, you're always meeting interesting people. It's not what I'm saying, right? But
no, I know what you mean. Well, for podcast movement was probably the biggest podcast conference I've been to. The ones that I've been to before actually were almost, I'd say maybe 10 years ago. Like, these were small, like little almost unconference style conferences, meaning that they didn't really have a lot of organization. People just kind of showed up and they talked about whatever.
Yeah.
But this was back in like 2005, 2006, when podcasting was still going on, but it's certainly not to the level of ubiquity that it is now in a number of different industries. So podcast movement was really interesting in that respect, to just see how many people are now in the space in so many different types of places, not just your indie podcasters, but you've got big media podcasters, you have brands that are getting into it, and then all the other sort of ancillary businesses that try to, you know, sort of sink their teeth into the podcast pie as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've been around to all that time, so you were already listening to podcasts at that time, 2005, 10 years?
I've been a podcaster for that long, just doing my own, like, random off the cuff stream of consciousness type shows. Nothing that I think was certainly super public facing, like what I'm doing with Revision Path, or even what I did last year with the Year of Tea. But I've been in the space for a long time, working with people with the Georgia Podcast Network, which is now defunct. But also listening to podcasts. NPR had a lot of podcasts, back then, not as many as they do now, because these were for different shows. I think each of their shows had a separate sort of podcast type component to it. So I was listening to a lot of news and stuff as I worked, and a lot of music podcasts.
Okay.
I was listening to, like, people would put together mixes of music and maybe give a little commentary or something like that.
Cool.
But to answer your earlier question though, about where do you kind of find the people that would be interested in your show? I had that sort of worry going into it as well, because the podcast movement crowd, at least from what I can tell, is much more geared towards business, entrepreneurship, into those realms. And design the design podcast realm that I'm somewhat familiar with doesn't really intersect with that very much at all, if at all.
Yeah.
And so I think for me, it's been easier to find people by just going through design circles, working with design organizations like AIGA, working with design thinking companies like Facebook or Vox Media. Like finding people that are just designers in the space has helped. And there are design communities online such as Designer News. Hacker News isn't really for designers. It's kind of more of a general all-purpose tech news, but that's another sort of place. But places that designers would congregate and talk about things online. Twitter, of course, is always a really good resource to try to find people.
To find people on Twitter. I agree, for sure.
So that's how I've been able to kind of network with a lot of folks.
Yeah, absolutely, makes total sense. And of course, like me, coming from a advertising, marketing, and branding background, and even the gaming side of things that I am interested in as well, as it's just directly through those things rather than podcasting, conference. This was the first, but it was really interesting. Cool, but it was great. It's great to hear, like, from your perspective and, like, the kind of conferences that you go to and find out about. And how did you get into, like, I guess the audio and podcasting in the first place? Was it through radio in the first place, or music, or?
It was through music. That's no one has ever asked me that. It was through music. So I started. I first started learning music and learning how to play music in middle school. So this is about like 7th, 8th grade. I picked up learning trombone, and I picked it up only because I wanted to get out of 7th period.
Really? So was trombone the main thing available? Was that,
I had my pick of any instrument. Uh-huh. And, I tried saxophone and I couldn't get the reed thing down. And I tried trumpet and I couldn't get the right embouchure because the mouthpiece was too small. And so trombone for me was perfect.
Okay.
Cool. My mom was probably be the first person to tell you, like, I picked up the music super easy. I picked up playing it really easily because, I mean, the trombone is just, it's a big slide.
Uh-huh.
And there's 7 positions on the slide. That's all you need to know. So it's actually a very easy instrument to learn. Mm. It's a very hard instrument to master.
Okay.
Because there's so few slides and there's no like exact positions. Like with trumpets, you have valves. With, you know, clarinets and with saxophones, you have valves and stuff. And there's so many different positions you can do with those keys. Whereas with trombone, it's really more about how good your pitch is and how well you can hear, whether you're sharp or flat or in tune, because the positions are not marked on the slide. It's just a big long slide.
Yeah.
And you have to remember what's first position, what's fourth, what's fifth, like what sounds like fifth position. So I started off learning music in middle school because I wanted to get out of 7th period, and I was interested in transposing video game soundtracks. Like I'm a big RPG fan, like Final Fantasy, all that stuff.
Awesome. Yeah.
And I would listen to the games and I love the music, and I wanted to take that same music and transpose it and just learn how to play it on my own so I could always play those same melodies or listen to a song off the radio and find a way that I could transpose that. So maybe we would play it in the band or something. Right. So
wow, that's brilliant.
So that's how I started, just with audio and recording in general. So I did that from about 7th grade up until, geez, maybe like senior year of college, perhaps. Yeah. So that's about a good, that's like 10 years.
Wow. Probably. So where is this? Sorry, by the way, like where'd you grow up?
Sorry. Yeah. So
No reason to know.
Yeah, this is in Alabama. I grew up in Selma, Alabama. So I started off kind of learning it there. And then I went to college in Atlanta, Georgia at Morehouse College. And I wasn't in the band there, but I did play just recreationally. And I sometimes would pick up a little side gig playing here or there.
Back up at a club or something like that. Classical, jazz, or blues?
I was playing a mix of stuff. So I started off in marching band. We were playing mostly like top 40 radio stuff.
Okay.
And then when I got to high school, I was, we played classical because I also competed in competitions. And so when you go to these like music competitions, you're always learning these either duets or you're learning these long classical pieces. For me, I was always learning polkas. Because they're very technically hard to do on a trombone. They're easy to do on a keyed instrument because you have exact positions, but you know, if you're playing something that's like a very lively polka and you're like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, it's not just making sure that you can tongue it right when you're playing, but you also have to get your arm, like it's a workout, you know?
And so, so like, I don't know anything about those music competitions. So like you would go for something really technically difficult and that would give you points and be more difficult for the other person to beat you? Or how does that, how does it go actually? I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it. I mean, people try to choose solos and things that will go towards, I guess, the level of technical accuracy that you have that shows the amount of skill that you have. Uh-huh. In a way, it's very much like, and this might be a stretch. I mean, I'm not a gymnast. Okay. But I feel like it's like gymnastics.
Okay.
Like when a gymnast plans out their floor routine, they're planning out the you know, rotations and the flips and things that they do that they know are going to have a higher technical value, so they'll get potentially a higher score.
But then the whole thing has to play and work together as well. Like it has to have some kind of harmony and play to the music and like that.
And so, yeah, and so you're playing and like the adjudicator is there and they're listening as you're doing it. And so you only have one shot, like there's no starting over. So you tell them when you're ready, you start, the metronome's going and you're just playing. And it's usually in a big empty room. So it's a little bit intimidating because it's so quiet, but you're playing and you're doing it and then you're done and they score it up. And then at the end of the day, they let you know kind of what your, like what your rankings are.
Yeah.
So yeah, in high school, I played everything from classical to top 40. We played a lot of jazz. We had a community college, Wallace Community College in Selma, and they had a jazz band there, and I guess they didn't have enough musicians in college, so I joined the jazz band my sophomore year in high school. So we played a lot of jazz. We played a lot of like 70s rock, like Blood, Sweat, and Tears and stuff like that. And then when I got to college, it was more kind of top 40 and just jazz stuff. Like I did a lot more improv stuff. Yeah.
And so like, because I grew up in France and I don't know from the US and or around Alabama, how is that perceived as in like in France, if you're playing music and if you're playing jazz, whatever the instrument, you'd probably be part of the cool kids automatically. Is that like, were you part of the cool kids or was it that what kind of like kind of groups of teens were you part of? Is it more of a geeky thing to be playing the trombone or more of a cool kid thing?
So I was probably, I don't know, I may be amending this a bit just because of times. It's been so long since I've been in high school, I feel like I was somewhere between the nerds and the cool kids because I was really smart. I was, you know, I studied a lot of stuff. I was captain of the math club and I was valedictorian in high school and all that stuff. So I was smart on that end, but then I also knew all the cool kids. And I mean, the band was just such a cool thing to be in, which I think I think this is different based on culture.
Yeah.
So usually when people talk about marching band in high school, you sometimes hear about it through pop culture as it being this very sort of geeky, sort of dorky thing.
Yeah.
But I don't mean to get super racial here, but I feel like that's more from a white point of view.
Okay.
I went to a majority black high school in a majority, well, not majority black town, but I went to a majority black high school and being in the marching band was it. Like you got to play all the best songs on the radio. You got to go on trips. You got to hang out around the majorettes. You got to, you know, like it was fun to be in the band. It was like a status symbol. And so even like going to football games, people went to football games to watch the team, but people really went to football games to watch the band.
Awesome.
And I mean, here in the States, there's a big like black marching band culture, particularly in colleges.
Okay.
And so, and it trickles down to high school too, but particularly in colleges, there's a huge, huge black marching band culture. There's like an annual competition called the Battle of the Bands. It's here in Atlanta every year. It's a huge, huge thing.
Oh, right.
So for me, it was kind of a status symbol. Like I could play an instrument and I was in the band and I was a section leader. So I had like that level of seniority as well.
That's awesome.
Was great. Like I never got the whole like weird band geek thing. Cause for me, being in band was like such a cool thing. Like I don't think anybody was in band that felt like they were a geek. It felt like if anything, you were part of this special club fraternity that other people weren't.
Yeah.
And you had all these perks that came with it.
Fantastic. Yeah, and certainly, like, to what you were saying on, you know, stereotypes is very true. Because, I mean, like, I grew up, and I still today am living in Europe, but I grew up with most of my references to American high schools were for movies. And, yeah. And most of the movies have mostly white stereotypes anyway. So, you know, there's certainly probably going to be, like, most of them coming from a white standpoint more than anything, mm-hmm. without, you know, being, as you said, like, you know, going crazy racial or whatever. But still, it's pretty much true.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, the marching band was great. I mean, yeah. And even when I did the jazz band stuff, when I was, you know, kind of doing that in high school, working with the community college, that was fun, too, because we had a different, like, uniform. Like, when I was in marching band, we had, you know, the standard kind of band jacket with the tuxedo pants, with the white, like, uncomfortable bandeau shoes. But then when I did the jazz band, we had white jackets and tuxedo shirts. You know, like, it was very, like, it looks dressy.
Pretty sharp.
Yeah, it was nice. And I mean, we got to play, you know, really nice jazz songs. We played at benefits. We played at a bunch of different things. So I got to really do a lot and see a lot of different parts of,
very cool.
I think, just my city that I don't think I would have gotten to do if I didn't get into music. So
that's really
me
cool.
Me getting into music is kind of what just interested me in audio in general. Because once I graduated from college and I wasn't playing as much anymore, I still kind of had recording equipment at home, you know, because I would have a keyboard. I would record myself playing, or I would record something off the radio and try to transpose it.
Uh-huh.
And podcasting was just starting to kind of take off, I think, around 2004, 2005. I was really starting to hear about it.
Yeah.
And there were services that were coming out, like Audio. I think Audio Boo had came out either.
I was playing with Audio Boo back in the day because I lived in London and the dude's from London in the first place.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So I started just kind of, you know, playing around, doing little, you know, just little shows and things. That was also when blogging really started to kind of take off a bit.
Yeah.
And it was interesting to kind of have a blog, but then you also had this sort of podcast component. I mean, this was before iTunes and before these sort of ways that you could really easily find podcasts. I remember, it's still through XML feeds and RSS feeds. That's still how we subscribe, but you certainly didn't have the robust directories and ways of discovery that you do now. So I think it's a lot easier to find better, I don't want to say better shows, but just to find more shows
There
is, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And I understand from having, like, done my checking around, like, you said you're really good at math and that's what you studied, like, in college, right?
Yeah, I was a math nerd in college. It's interesting because I didn't initially go that route. I started off being a computer science and computer engineering major. We had this sort of dual degree program that was a partnership with Georgia Tech here in Atlanta, where you would do 3 years at Morehouse, and then you'd do 2 years at Georgia Tech, and you'd graduate with two degrees. You'd have a degree in your computer science from Morehouse, and then you'd have another degree from Georgia Tech in your engineering discipline.
Okay.
And so I started off doing that for about I wouldn't even say a full semester, maybe like a half semester, because I just was not getting the programming stuff. The teacher that we had was, I want to say the teacher that we had just was not good. Okay. I'm going to just be kind. I'll be kind and say he was just not a good teacher. He would spend the majority of the class going over anecdotes from his youth about his fishing buddies and things of that nature. And then once the time for the class was done and people were leaving, then he would start teaching. And it's like, you know, I don't understand why you're sort of turning this into some kind of laborious trial. Like we're all here to learn. Why don't you just teach us during the time that we're supposed to be in your class? And so this was also around the time when the web was starting to take off. And I had been playing around with the web really since high school. We had a supercomputing lab at our high school. And so I learned about HTML and everything. And even before that, I had access to Apple IIe computers.
Yeah. Was there any link with your interest in video games as well? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I first started, so if we're really trying to take it back,
why not? Let's
I was gonna say when I was much, much younger, I'd say maybe about like 7 or 8, maybe. I want to say right around that age. I had a computer that was passed down from my brother called a Laser 50. It's like this computer from VTech, and it's, I want to say it's about the size of a actual like computer keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a keyboard, but it also has logic in there where you can do programming. So I learned BASIC when I was in elementary school, and we'd go to the library and get BASIC books and stuff. And then once I started getting into my gifted and enrichment program classes in like second grade, we had access to the Apple IIe. So we learned how to program in BASIC. We learned how to do computer graphics in BASIC. So by the time I got to high school, which was in the mid 90s, I kind of just had this interest in the web in general.
Yeah.
We were learning how to do HTML. We were learning how to reverse engineer websites and build our own websites. So by the time I got to college, I was really like, I want to do something with the web.
Yeah.
And I went to that teacher and told him what I wanted to do. And I showed him some websites that I had done. And I told him, this was also right the same year I started doing freelance work. Was it 99? I was like, yeah, and I've already got a few clients I'm doing work for. And awesome. And I really want to kind of learn more about it. And he's like, you should probably change your major because you're not going to learn that here. Like, right. This is computer science. You're going to learn about the fundamentals of computer science and assembly programming. And we don't do anything with the web. The web is a fad. I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
All right. Well, and so I changed my major from computer science and computer engineering to just computer science. And then I changed it to math because I did that in the interim so I could find out what the best major was going to be based on the number of credits that I already had kind of coming into college.
Hmm.
And I had taken AP calculus in high school and we had taken some college courses for calculus. And so I already had a good head start into the math program. That coupled with me being, you know, president of the math leets and whatnot in high school, it was like, yeah, sure, I'll just go into math. It'll be fun. Like, actually, it shaved half a year off of me being in college because I already kind of started ahead a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I'll do math. It's not a problem.
Wow.
And I loved it. I loved math.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I know people go to college and it's about, you know, making sure that you do a major that's really going to get you a job.
Mm-hmm.
I was not thinking about that. I don't know if I should have been thinking about that. I was just thinking that I really like math. I really like my classes. And that's just what I did.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do anything outside of that afterwards, though. Like by the time I got to senior year, I, you know, was trying to find a job. And the only jobs, actually, they didn't have any jobs available in my department. They just said, you should go to graduate school.
Mm.
And I'm like, I don't want to go to graduate school. I've been going to school for, you know, 16 years now. I want a break. Like,
yes.
Where can I get a job with this degree? And they're like, well, you should probably look at graduate school. Like, I think that's probably going to be your best bet. And I'm not going to lie. I was very crafty in the ways that I, you know, tried to get interviews with other companies and was successful in getting interviews with other companies. But, eventually, by the time I graduated, I was selling tickets at the box office for the symphony because I couldn't find a job.
Yeah, yeah. Crafty, you know? Like an example of something crafty you did to get an interview?
Okay, so
while we're at it,
I don't know if I'm probably not going to get into trouble for this. Like the statute of limitations has completely run out for this.
Oh,
so,
is it that bad?
No. It's not bad. It's just it's enterprising. Let's put it that way. So. Okay. I got in when I was a freshman. I got in really good with the computer science department at Morehouse, particularly with the secretary there. And I think if anybody that has been to a black college, I would say I feel like this might be just representative of college in general, but specifically for black colleges, if you get in good with the secretary of your department, you basically have carte blanche to do whatever you want within that department. Because the secretary is the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
They can get you into any of the rooms. They know the professor schedules. They know the chair schedules. They're the nexus of the department.
Yeah.
And so I got in really good with the secretary at Morehouse College. Mm. Her name is Martha Banks. Got in really good with her. And I mean, she's a wonderful woman. I mean, have been to her house, have had dinner there. She's a wonderful woman. But the time that I spent there working, doing work study, and I would often just kind of check in because, I mean, I wasn't a computer science student. I was in the math department.
Yeah.
But I would always kind of come through and I would volunteer and do work in her office. And I did that for a number of years to the point where I was kind of the second in command. Let me not boast myself that much, but I certainly got to the point where she instilled enough trust in me to be able to kind of handle certain things within the department without her directly looking over me. One of those things was this book of interviews. So we had, you know, companies that would come to the school that would interview for, you know, certain departments and whatnot. Hmm. And so for the computer science department, and this is like the late 90s. Oh, no, yeah. This is like, let's say like early 90s. No, late early 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, okay.
So we'd have companies like Microsoft, Real Player, yes. Goldman Sachs, et cetera, yeah. You know, would come through. And so I would just, you know, write my name in the interview book. Like this happened, I want to say starting junior year, because the scholarship program that I was in was for, I thought when I got the scholarship that I was guaranteed a job after college, because the scholarship was a NASA scholarship. So I interned at two NASA facilities here in the U.S. my freshman year and my sophomore year.
Got it.
And so after that, I, you know, was kind of thinking, well, what, you know, what is my next goal, you know, kind of going to be? Like, should I start thinking about what NASA facility I want to work at and all this kind of stuff? And then September 11th happened. Mm. So this is, you know, right around that time. And so there was some questionable kind of things going on with the funding, and they weren't sure if they would be able to place scholarship recipients that were in my class in any sort of in any of the NASA facilities. They just didn't know, because they didn't know what the funding was looking like. Because at that time, that's when the Department of Homeland Security had started and funds were being diverted, and it was very up in the air.
Right.
And so that left my prospects for work after college up in the air. I didn't know where I was going. And so that's when I, you know, got back with the computer science department, and I saw this book of interviews, and I'm like, I can get some interviews here.
Yeah.
So I would write my name in for a few interviews. I, you know, did some interviews. I interviewed with Microsoft, interviewed with Real Player, interviewed with some other companies. None of them panned out, but at least I got the opportunity, you know.
That's great. Certainly training.
Yeah. I mean, because in the math department, all they were saying was, you need to go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. So I need to find something else to do.
And I understand, like, I mean, you've had other jobs. You've been working for yourself for quite a while. Did you get on to working for yourself and still working with your own clients after that? Or did that come later?
Oh, yeah. So I've been doing freelance work on the side since, I would say, before high school, maybe. So when I'm saying freelance stuff, I also have a lot of other like skills and hobbies of things that I do. Like I had a tutoring business in elementary school. Hmm. I did, this is gonna be so funny. Right. In second grade, we learned how to do cross stitch. Like it's a method of like decorative stitching.
Okay.
So I learned how to do that in second grade. My mom is a seamstress. My grandmother is a seamstress as well.
Okay.
So I learned how to do that.
That's awesome.
And so I would make like Christmas ornaments every year. I would charge people to like fix holes in their pants and socks. I did that. I did that a lot through college.
Wow.
You would be surprised how many people come to college and don't know how to wash clothes. They get a hole in something. They need to buy something new. And I'm like, oh, I'll fix that for this much money. And, you know, it's not a ton of money, but it's something. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Everything else when you're studying.
Yeah, so I've always been kind of doing something by myself on the side for a long time.
Awesome.
It wasn't until I got into college when it was really doing stuff on the web, like doing websites and creating logos and business cards and stuff like that. So by the time I struck out on my own in 2008 and started my business, I probably had a good, I don't know, maybe 10 plus years of already doing side projects for a long time before I decided this is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So I felt really good going into it, knowing that I know how to deal with clients. I know how to handle money. I know how to do the things to kind of keep the business going. Hmm. And so years later, from 2008, here I am.
Yeah. Got it. Cool. And so like we got definitely like the interest in wanting to do stuff on the web, and I imagine, I mean, you know, websites. And how did the, Because you were like really on the on, you started on the tech side of things and veered on the design and doing everything yourself, from what I understand. Where did was the interest in design already there? Did it come like as you were studying the web and as you were studying websites? Or because like some people you could have easily said, well, I'm really, really interested in the development and programming side of things and want to work in a team and, you know, not be less interested in design, for example.
Yeah. I think that, you know, technology has grown to the point where it feels like technology and design are merging in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
I definitely started out doing more programming than design, because I think when we think about, oh, that's such an interesting way to look at it. Cause, you know, as kids, we do a lot of stuff with drawing and art and things like that. And I'm not sure if we consider that design at that age.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's more about like, I guess, expressing creativity or whatever. But yes, then the older we get, the less we do that. And it's more about, you know, studying history and mathematics and science and all these other things.
Yeah.
But I kind of was always like sketching and doodling and stuff like that. I mean, I never really considered that being design per se when I was in high school. It wasn't until I got to college when I, you know, saw web design that it felt like it was a marriage between doing the coding stuff that I learned how to do with HTML and stuff.
Yeah.
As well as like making pretty pictures in Photoshop and stuff. Yeah. Like it felt like, to me, both of those things were always kind of intrinsically linked.
Mm, mm.
I know now that, you know, certainly there are people that are specialists. There are designers who only design and don't code anything.
Yeah.
There are coders that only program and don't design anything. I don't come from that school. I come from the school where you have to do everything.
Yeah.
You have to code it. You have to design it. So I've always, I think, had my hand in both of those pots, mm-hmm. so to speak. Cool. Certainly as I started doing my business, what ended up happening is that I was doing much less both coding and design and more administrative work.
Yes.
I think as anybody with a business will tell you, I mean,
I freelanced as well. So like keeping the books and looking for new clients does like eat up some time.
Yeah. Like it's a lot of, you know, business development stuff. And it felt like I was getting less and less away from actually creating something, like getting my hands wet, making something, you know, that kind of feeling. So, I think that ebbs and flows. Certainly, I think as you get further along in your business, you learn how to delegate, you find ways to take out the things that you don't have to do yourself in order to do more of the things that made you want to get into business. I think that's just something that happens over the course of entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
But I don't know when, if it ever like clicked over. Like I always felt like I was doing both things at the same time.
Yeah. Did you feel like you had one major driver or like either driver or strength or asset to go into doing things or working for yourself and building your own business?
I would have to say my main driver has always been strategy. Like being able to come up with a plan and execute the plan has always been my biggest strength. It's why I've been able to do, I think, a lot of the projects that I've done is, you know, anybody can have an idea, you know, ideas are generally worthless.
Yeah.
I feel ideas are worthless. Other people might not think that. Certainly there are a lot of people that will have you sign an NDA just to tell you what their idea is. But if you're not able to actually, if you're not able to actually execute on it, it's worthless. And so, for me to have the idea to do something and then being able to think of, okay, this is how I'll be able to put this together.
Yeah.
Is how it works. Like when I came up with Revision Path, for example,
yes,
I literally came up with that idea in the shower.
Okay. This is perfect. So can you tell us like a bit more background, and at the same time you can tell us about Revision Path and about the podcast itself?
Yeah. So, I mean, I literally came up with the idea for Revision Path. I came up with most of my ideas in the shower, actually. But that one particularly in the shower, like thinking, you know, I had actually just come off doing a very big project that I did from 2004 to 2011. I did this big project called the Black Weblog Awards. And
yes, that's another one I wanted to talk about there for sure.
Yeah, we can talk about that. So I sold that in 2011. And I sort of still had this idea in mind to do something that was recognizing and showcasing black designers and what we were doing. And I felt like now I've got the time to do it. But what should it be? Should it be a podcast? Should it be just interviews? You know, I was trying to think of what it would be. And at the time I was thinking, you know, the main thing is that you just need to start. Mm-hmm. So think of a name, think of a domain, come up with like a generic color scheme or something. Like for me, it's always good to at least start somewhere.
Yeah.
Because you can always have an upgrade path.
Yes.
I never think that you have to just start perfectly. It's just important that you start.
Yes.
And so when I started Revision Path at first, I mean, it was pretty rough. I mean, we still have the same logo and kind of the same color scheme, but it was pretty rough just in terms of the execution, like trying to find people to interview, because this was something that was totally new to me.
Yeah.
All the other shows that I had done was just me talking into a microphone. It wasn't me trying to like find another person and come up with questions and, you know, that sort of thing. So at first I would do the interviews just over email. We would sort of send questions back and forth and you know, put them all together and put them on a page. And eventually it turned into a podcast when someone who had been reading the interviews, just like it was a random designer. She's from Chicago. Mm-hmm. She reached out to me saying that she was going to be in town and wanted to know if she could do an interview. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, let me come up with some questions. She's like, no. Like, can we just like meet at a restaurant and record? And I'm thinking, I didn't have any like portable recording equipment. Like I had I have equipment to like record at home. I didn't have, you know, stuff. I was like, oh, I don't want to take my laptop and my mic and all this stuff. So we recorded on the phone that I had at the time, which was like it was the first Google phone that came out. I remember that was the phone Nexus. I had.
Cool.
It wasn't the Nexus. It was the G1.
Oh yes, it of was, course. Yes. Sorry,
That like folded up. Yeah, it was a.
There was another one before. I forgot about it. Sorry.
And I mean, the audio is terrible. Like, it's the first episode of the podcast. The audio is really bad because I put the phone on the table, not realizing that every time we hit the table, it would pick up that vibration and the restaurant was kind of noisy. Like, I tried to clean it up in Audacity. It just wasn't that great.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't know if I should do this podcast thing again. But eventually it sort of morphed into that because it became harder and harder for people to respond to the emails in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. It was just much easier to get someone for an hour and talk to them and put that up.
Yeah.
And so eventually I just sort of got a good backlog of podcasts together and then officially launched the podcast itself in 2014.
Awesome.
Even though we had started Revision Path in 2013, I did the podcast in 2014. And so from there, it's been a regular weekly kind of thing. We're at 100 and goodness, I think
that
we're recording this.
Was it?
Oh, no, this week we're recording. We're 158.
158. So there you go.
158 episodes. Been able to interview people pretty much all over the world. I mean, mostly here in the US, but also in the Caribbean, in Europe, in several countries in Africa. Love to kind of branch out more and talk to more people. So, and we've gotten the support of design organizations like AIGA. We have financial support from Hover, from MailChimp, from Facebook, which is really good.
That's awesome.
And I don't know when this episode is going to be released, but this is going to be kind of
in about a month's time or so.
In about a month's time. Okay, so this will be
confirm the date with you, but.
Okay. Well, this will be an exclusive for your show then, because probably by the time this airs, I will be at Facebook headquarters.
Okay.
Recording interviews for the show.
That's super exciting.
Yeah, we're going to do, I think, 4 interviews while I'm out there. And then I'm also speaking as part of their design lecture series. So that actually just materialized this week. So you are literally the first person that I'm telling about.
That's fantastic.
This.
So are the design lectures usually broadcasted online later, or?
I will have to ask.
I'm not
sure. Because I know they're, at least from what they were telling me, it's kind of short. I think they're like 25 to 30 minutes. And I'll actually be coming up with a new presentation that I'm doing out there where I do talk about how I built Revision Path and kind of the journey that I've gone to.
And you've won awards as well for the show, haven't you?
Yeah, last year we won Creative Markets. Creative Market did their inaugural Creative Market Awards, and
yeah.
we won Most Inspiring Design Podcast, which I don't know how that happened, because any of the podcasts that we were up against, I'm like, you all could eat my lunch in terms of downloads any day of the week. Like Debbie Millman's Design Matters, Mark Bricky's Adventure in Design, like big shows with big followings that have been around for a long time, longer than my show.
Right.
And I was just so humbled and excited to win that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. We'll have to talk. Oh, thank you. We'll have to talk after we recorded about what some of the interesting feedback has been from that.
Sure.
I'll just say that there's not a lot of what's the best way to put this? That sounds democratic. There are award-winning podcasts out there that win, you know, the podcast award or Streamy or whatever, you know, other awards are out there for podcasts. Those are generally not really conferred to design podcasts.
Yes.
Design podcasts, at least from, and this is just my general view of being in the space for a while, they tend to operate in kind of this wannabe cool kid space. Where yeah. everyone's like, yeah, you know, I'm too, you know, we're two guys and we're talking about design. We're going to talk about the latest thing coming out from Apple and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, everybody's doing that.
Yes.
You know, you know, two guys in a garage in San Francisco or whatever, like everyone's doing that. Like, that's not super unique. What you're doing is completely interchangeable from show to show to show in terms of the topics, in terms of the people, like what's the unique thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, part of the uniqueness of Revision Path is the fact that, one, I'm black.
Yeah.
Two, my guests are black.
Yeah.
But the things that we talk about are not, they're not, it's not always about race and diversity.
Yeah.
And I really try to make that a concerted effort when I speak to people. Yeah.
Well, I've listened to a couple of episodes. I mean, I haven't listened to so many. I've only listened to a few of them, and I'm interested in design and I love listening to the show. It's great that it's about diversity, but that's generally not really what most of the episodes are about, which is, I mean, it's not the reason why I would or no wouldn't enjoy it, but it's, I'm just confirming. I agree with you. It's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, cause I think it would get, first it would just get boring to me. I would just be bored if the only thing we're talking about every week is what's diversity in design like? What's diversity in technology? Like, there are times when we do bridge those topics and sure. I make sure that it's done in a way that's relevant to the guest and maybe at the time that the podcast is being aired. But I don't try to go like into a complete non sequitur about like, so you're black and you design. What's that about?
Yes.
Like, so, you know, like I try not to go there. Like, I feel like because me and my guests both have that shared or those shared traits, we don't have to talk about that. And one way that already gives a level of, I think, comfort and familiarity, I'd say about 95% of the people I've had on the show have never given an interview.
Yeah.
But I think me coming at them just being like, hey, you know, we're just going to talk about you and your process and that's it. Like, it's more about them. I try to take myself out of it as much as I can. There are times when I do go on anecdotes where I feel it's relevant, but
sure.
I try to take myself out of the interview as much as I can, to the point where even the episode art for the show is just the guest.
Mm.
Like, that's it. It's the guest. I've got a little, you know, Revision Path icon in the corner. That's it. I've certainly seen some design podcasts where everything is about the host.
Mm.
And that's, I get that. I get that from a branding standpoint. I just try to take myself out of it, because for me, I'm looking at the bigger picture of, you know, each of these conversations is contributing to the overall conversation about design and about people that are in the design industry.
Yeah.
And for so long, these people's voices have not been heard. I don't want to be the person that puts myself between their story and the rest of the community.
Yeah.
So I'm just giving them the platform to speak.
That's great. And do you find you're learning a lot from them as well, like for yourself as a designer and for your own business as a professional?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I've certainly heard about aside from just different design opportunities, but different ways of doing business, different branches of doing business. Like, I'll give you an example. This maybe about, I want to say at least 2 years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that. We had a presentation specialist on the show. A presentation specialist is someone who does basically PowerPoint and keynote presentations.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this guy, I mean, he's done them for Apple, for Facebook. Like, he's done them for all the big companies out in the Bay Area. And I'm thinking, I didn't know that was a thing someone was getting paid six figures to do.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking when I used to work at for the state of Georgia, and I'm putting together PowerPoints, like, oh, this is so boring.
Yes.
You know, not thinking that somebody is actually getting paid to do this. Like,
what's funny is, sorry, just to interrupt, but it was similar to what you were talking about earlier about your studies, and you might have come across this Alan Watts video that's like shared around. There's millions of views on it. Who's a 60s philosopher, an English teacher. And it was a portion from a radio interview where he goes a lot about, oh, well, my students are asking me about, you know, what should I study? What would be the good degree to get the right kind of job, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And in short, it goes, well, basically just, you know, like, given the market and given what's going on, just study and go for whatever you're passionate about. Because if you're really passionate about something, become a master at it. And if you're a master at something, you'll find a market for it.
Right. Absolutely. And yeah, with the show, I mean, I really have just tried to, I really want to say I've tried to not make it about me.
Yeah.
I've tried to make it about the guest. And I think just the overall goal and mission of sharing these people's stories with the world. And, you know, the guests will come back to me all the time and say, you know, because of your interview, I've gotten this job.
That's
or
awesome.
Because of your interview, now I'm speaking here. Or because of your interview, now I've got this opportunity. And it wouldn't have happened if they wouldn't have come on the show, if they mm-hmm. wouldn't have had that opportunity to actually really just speak about what they do and speak about their work.
Yeah.
I certainly know that people will look at our archives page on Revision Path and they will see a sea of over 150 black faces and just think, oh, it's just a black show.
Right.
And that, you know, there's so much diversity within that. There's age diversity. There's, you know, occupation diversity. I mean, they're all designers or developers in some way, but just the level of the different things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
There's men, there's women, there's trans people, there's straight, gay in the U.S., outside the U.S. Like, there's so much variety within what you think might look like just a monolith that I think it's worth exploring. So, I really try to keep that in mind every time when I'm thinking about who would be a good guest or what would be, you know, a good thing to talk about. I'm always trying to keep that, I guess, diversity within diversity in a way in mind.
That's awesome. All right. So I'm just mindful of time. We're like this conversation is flowing really, really much faster than I thought, which is fantastic. And before, like I'd usually, before we move on to the last kind of segment where I have a couple of ice cream related questions, I really wanted to ask you about a year of tea, which is the project that you had last year. And, can you just like sum it up and tell us quickly?
Yeah. So the year of tea was, at the time I was calling it a 365 project, but it was this project where I wanted to review a different tea every day.
Yeah.
And by tea, I mean, a tea that you drink. I did it in podcast form. It was a very short burst podcast. Each episode is less than 5 minutes. And I just reviewed a different tea every day. And the reason I did that is because I love tea. I have a huge tea collection.
Yeah.
I've often just bought teas and never drank them. And I was running out of space. And I needed, a reason to go through everything. I had like this tea journal thing, like a Moleskine tea journal, but I was like, I'm not going to write in that.
Where does the tea thing start?
I don't know where that started. I want to say it started in college drinking really bad tea while studying.
Right.
Like drinking really bad, like Bigelow tea and not knowing like how long the bag has been around, but it's there. So you drink it, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's where it started. It probably blossomed the summer that I lived in California when I did my first internship at Ames Research Center in Mountain View, in Moffett Field, which is right outside of Mountain View. And I really started, I think, getting into tea then because there's pho shops out there and there's authentic tea houses. And like, that's when I first got introduced to sushi. And so that was when I just sort of started to get more of an appreciation for it. But I've got this big tea collection at home and I needed to go through it and get rid of some of it. And that was just kind of the best way to do it. So I did, you know, one episode a day, 365 episodes, and it was good. I got, you know, some good. Actually, companies started sending me teas. Honest Tea, Rishi Tea, a lot of other companies started actually sending me things they wanted me to review. Numi Organic Tea sent me like this big chest of tea with like a pound of this custom blend and everything. Like a lot of tea companies were really excited about it because there are tea podcasts out there, but they're boring. Like they're like 10 minutes long. Nobody has time to listen to all of that. My whole goal was that, you know, I want the review to be as short as the time it takes you to brew a cup of tea.
Okay.
So that was my whole goal. Like I get in there, I tell you, this is where it's from. These are the ingredients. I've got a good high quality picture of the tea. I brewed it at this long, at this temperature. Uh-huh. This is what it tastes like. If you want it for yourself, here's where you buy it. And that's it.
Okay.
I tried not to make it any more complicated than that. And it's interesting that in 2015, no other tea company has thought to do that, thought to put out a podcast or a show or anything like that. You know, I mean, so much of the other thing I wanted to do with the Year of Tea is kind of clear up, I think, the Western mysticism around tea. A lot of it is just a cheap marketing ploy, I think.
Yes, to get people to
buy into it. I mean, tea is like the second most consumed beverage in the world. Like it's not that mystical. But here in the U.S., and I don't know how it is in Europe, but like it has this really strong mystical health connotation. And I mean, it has that, you know, but it's also extremely mundane. Like like loose leaf tea is not this thing you need to be afraid of or scared of. Like it's pretty simple. You can actually put it together yourself if you want to. So I tried to make sure that I got some of the mysticism and that secretiveness away from discovering new teas and new tea blends and tea flavors and tea companies. So I hope that the show has accomplished that. People wanted me to do a second year and I'm like, no, I'll just do the 1 year.
Yeah. It's pretty good commitment to do a 365 day project. It's awesome, I think.
Yeah. Because people are like, are there even 365 teas out there? I'm like, oh, yes.
Yes, definitely.
There's even more like tea blends and stuff like that. But if I do it another year, I don't know. I haven't decided if I'm going to take it on for another year. But I just wanted to do it in 2015 and see where it goes.
All right. That's cool. It's a lot of fun. Okay. So, yeah, let's just go through the like what I usually call the cool down questions, because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. And I usually have to – I don't have to, but I do integrate some kind of ice cream related question. Or okay. Questions. Well, let's just start with the easy one. Like, do you have a favorite flavor?
My favorite flavor is Cherry Garcia from Ben & Jerry.
Which goes well with the last name. That's excellent.
I know, right? It's like it's pretty obvious in a weird sort of way, but I really do like Cherry Garcia.
Awesome. And if you were like, so if you're approaching a design brief to do with ice cream, I'm making this one up on the spot. I'm trying to come up with something interesting as I'm doing it. This is bad. Normally I prepare them in advance, but so either if you were designing an ice cream flavor, what would it be? Or if you're designing, let's say, a website for an ice cream, where would you start?
So I am a big person when it comes to texture in design. I mean, we see a lot of, I know the whole kind of design style for a while was about, you know, flat design and stuff like that. But texture doesn't always necessarily have to be 3D, you know, skeuomorphism kind of thing. It can be a repeated icon. It can be film grain. Like there's just ways that you can add subtle textures to colors and things like that. So I would want to do something that has that type of, if I'm approaching an ice cream website, of course I'd want to look at, you know, what each of their flavors are.
Sure.
Of course, I want to taste each of their flavors, but I want to take that into consideration when I'm designing. Like, I feel like it would be hard. I feel like it's hard to design food sites without experiencing the food. Maybe that's just me. Like, I feel like there's got to be that extra sense to it so you can really get an idea of what the brand is trying to put forth. If it was my own ice cream, I would probably make a churros ice cream.
Oh, that's a good point.
So it would have like a lightly sweet vanilla base with like cinnamon sugar and like churro bits in it. So that's, like, it's a little sandy, but not like gritty.
Yeah.
I would make something like that.
That's a very cool answer. I like that a lot. Very, very cool. Very cool answer. It's interesting because like what you were just saying about experiencing the product that you're going to be designing for, and I really like massively agree with. And tell me what you think. But in my experience, increasingly the last years and, you know, in the different marketing agencies I've worked with, as I work as a marketing strategist, brand and marketing strategist. And in my role, typically, whatever we're going to be doing, whether it's a marketing campaign or a website or whatever it is, my job is to understand the people that are going to be in the receiving end of this. And traditionally, you know, you go and talk to them to understand who they are and what they're about and what's going on with them. And more so because timelines are being squeezed, because margins are being squeezed. You know, what's being requested is just, well, basically go and look on Google and try to find some kind of key facts and then just go into design because there's no time to actually do the work. Do you find that kind of challenges with client as well? Like demanding things faster and faster and not really having the time to experience the business and the products you're trying to design for?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, clients, and I try to tell clients that when they are first approaching me and they've got an idea for, you know, whatever it is that they want to put forth in their design, you know, I want them to be ready to hit the ground running when we're ready to go, but there's a process that leads up to it. So like, I want to send out a proposal. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure we're on the same page on the proposal.
Yeah.
I want to get a contract signed so we're both covered. And then once we get that first deposit, we're ready to go. Like yeah. We're ready to kind of move forward. A lot of people want to skip all that sort of preliminary process. And the problem is that if we end up skipping it, we're still going to have to come back to it later.
Yes.
And it's probably going to take longer because we're now doing it not just within the context of the project, which is taking up time, but now it's really costing you money because the longer it goes, we're going to have to tack on for scope creep and things of that nature.
Yeah.
I try to let clients know, you know, just to be a little bit patient in the beginning so we can get all of the preliminary stuff out of the way. Like I said, I try to approach things with a strategy. Mm-hmm. And for me, I put that strategy in the proposal to let them know that, you know, this is where we are kind of moving into everything. Mm. And then my strategy just in terms of onboarding deals with the proposal, with the contract, with the deposit to make sure that everything is squared away. So once we're ready to go, there's no, oh, can we do this? Yes. Oh, can we do that? You know, well, no, we can do what you signed off on because that's what you're paying me for.
Yes.
If it's anything extra, we can maybe add it on at the end. But right now, we're doing exactly what you signed off for because this is what we've got the time Absolutely. For. And this is what you've got the budget for.
It keeps things healthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Cool. This is awesome. The last question, they usually alternate between my interviews on the gaming side of things and the marketing. So I ask about gaming. So you already mentioned it. I don't know if you still play a lot of games or, but generally what's your, you said RPGs earlier. Did you have a favorite game growing up and like favorite games now?
So my favorite games growing up were RPGs. I would say my absolute favorite RPGs, there's three. Well, okay. No, let me take that back. There's four.
Okay.
There's Final Fantasy IV, which released in the U.S. is Final Fantasy II.
Okay.
There's Final Fantasy VI, which released in the U.S. is Final Fantasy III. There is Chrono Trigger. And there's Terranigma. So both Final Fantasy IV and VI are by Square. Oh, and Chrono Trigger. They're all by Square.
Yeah.
And then Terranigma is by Enix. So, yes. Of course, Square and Enix afterwards. Eventually yeah, merge. Yeah. Terranigma is a very little known RPG. I really only got into it in college when I learned about emulators and how you could play, you know, games from Nintendo on your computer and stuff like that. But it's an RPG that kind of tracks this young kid from underground to the overground, and he's responsible for creating civilization. So the game kind of takes you from the caveman age to the stone age to the industrial age to the future. It's a really good, interesting kind of story. I would love to see that game actually kind of redone and brought to the States, because right. I don't think it's a game that a lot of people have played. I heard it was big in Europe, but I'll have to check.
I wonder if it has a different title or something, because I haven't heard that title. So I'll have a look at around and definitely like chase for a link to a trailer or something like that.
Yeah, and so right now I would say my favorite games. Yeah, so those are like older games, but like my favorite games now, I'm a big fan of the Persona RPG series by Atlus. Hmm. Right now, Persona 5 will be coming out next year. It actually just came out in Japan this September. But
okay, I don't know that
it'll
series.
Be coming. Yeah, it'll be coming out to the U.S. and probably Europe, I think, next year.
Cool.
The Persona series, it's an RPG. It's a little bit, I say it's a mix between an RPG, a dungeon crawler, and like Pokemon.
Okay.
And the reason that I say that is because you end up fighting, you know, monsters within this, you know, often these different levels and dungeons and stuff. But the monsters that you gain, your quote unquote personas, mm-hmm. you can merge them to create stronger personas, but they've got to be the right type. And you had to, you know, it's like all these conditions that have to go along with it. So there's a level of strategy within the game. I guess you can tell, I even like strategy in my game. So
yes. That's cool.
So there's that part of it. And then there's also the venerable Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney series. Well, just the Ace Attorney series, but the main character is Phoenix Wright. And the latest one that's out now here in the U.S. is Phoenix Wright Ace Attorney Spirit of Justice. And so it's the sixth game in the series. That's sort of ending out the second part of the trilogy. Mm-hmm. And I'm only halfway through it right now. I've been trying to find time to play it. But it's basically like a visual novel, but it also involves strategy because you're a lawyer and you're solving cases in court by doing investigations and getting evidence and proving your case. I mean, I find it exciting and thrilling. Like I will play that game for hours. Most people will think you're not shooting anything. You're not racking up points. Like, why are you playing this? Like it's boring, but I love it. Absolutely love it.
Awesome. Cool. All right. Great. Well, this was a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for your time. So to close things off, I just want to make sure that people know where to find you. So like, what are the best places to find you and whether there's any kind of events coming up or things that people should watch out for, like speaking? I mean, definitely they can listen to you and your guests every week on Revision Path. That's for sure.
Yeah. So my website is mauricecherry.com, mauricecherry.com, like the fruit. On there, there's links to my Tumblr, my LinkedIn, my Twitter, and the projects that I'm working on, you know, kind of at the time. And then, of course, Revision Path is at revisionpath.com, revisionpath.com.
Yeah.
And you can also find Revision Path on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Revision Path.
Awesome. And I think that's about it. Did you say there's any, well, there's going to be the Facebook design things. Well, if
there's... Oh, yeah, yeah. By the time this airs, I will be... Yes. Either at Facebook or coming back from Facebook. Cool. I'll be doing 4 interviews there, which will air during the month of November, which will be our Facebook month.
Yeah.
Awesome. Facebook's been a big sponsor, so they get their own month. But great. Yeah, they'll be airing in November. So definitely make sure you listen out for those.
Great. Fantastic. All right. Brilliant. Thank you so much, Maurice, and all the best with the rest of the podcast.
All right. Thank you so much. Right. Thanks for having me on again. This was fun.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. That was a great episode, wasn't it? It was a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with Maurice. I think he enjoyed it as well. So watch out for the next episodes coming up. We've got a couple of episodes coming up before the end of the year. Should be quite exciting. And if you want to leave me feedback, just as I said at the beginning, send this to a friend or go check out for more content and more episodes on the Ice Cream for Everyone website. That's at www.icecreamforeveryone.net. Sign up for the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter. Find out more about myself. Please keep in touch. Tell me if you enjoyed the show. Give me some feedback. Ask questions. Don't hesitate. And that's about it for now. Have a fantastic day, morning, evening, night, whatever time it is for you. And hopefully, see you next time.